You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Good evening. This is Stephen Novella, the host of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and this is a special episode about the H1N1, or swine flu, and the vaccine. For this episode, I am joined by several of my colleagues from science-based medicine. So joining me for this episode are David Gorski.
Hello.
Mark Krislip.
Hello.
And Joe Allbeats.
Hi there.
Joe, we're going to start by talking a little bit about the flu itself, influenza. A little bit of quick background on influenza and specifically what we should be expecting this season with the flu.
Sure. So influenza is nothing new. I mean, it's a virus that we see every single year. And on average, on a normal flu season, we've got about 5 to 20% of the population that gets infected, about 200,000 people hospitalized, and about 30,000 people in the U.S. are killed from influenza and pneumonia subsequent to influenza. Typical infection that people are going to see is fever, chills, muscle aches, cough, congestion, occasionally some diarrhea, although that's more common in kids. And after only about 1 to 2 days of incubation, this thing can hang around for several days and sometimes up to 2 weeks. In the past, it's had a very distinct impact on the population in general. We've got 60% of hospitalizations and 90% of all influenza-related deaths occur in people over the age of 65. So even though children, for instance, being a pediatrician, have a very high rate of infection, their actual mortality from it is quite low. Only about 100 children a year tend to die from seasonal flu. Flu has a couple of things that make it unique virus-wise. Its genome is an RNA, and that's not real uncommon, of course, but it does give it a very high rate of mutation. It's one of the highest mutating viruses that we know of. About one in every 1,000 base pairs is mutated. But the thing that is unique about it is that its genome was split up into 8 pieces, and that gives influenza its ability to shift. So if someone, animal, human, anyone, is co-infected with a couple of different influenza strains at once, you have the ability to recombine those to form an entirely new virus. And if that virus happens to be easily transmitted and of a subtype that people haven't been exposed to, you are set up for a pandemic. Currently, we've got 3 major types of influenza that circulate and make up the seasonal flu. That's H3N2, H1N1, and influenza B. And people shouldn't be confused. That's a distinct H1N1 from what we've been seeing this season. So that kind of brings us into what this H1N1 is, and the misleadingly named swine flu. It's another influenza A, of course, but it was a quadruple recombination. It's got genes from pigs, or from strains that are commonly seen in pigs, humans, birds. It popped up on March 18th in 2009 back in Mexico. It took about 4 weeks to cross the border into the U.S., and after only 2 more weeks, it was in every state and about 23 countries, and only 3 months after its emergence, it was declared a pandemic by the World Health Organization. H1N1 has been really unique and a little bit alarming from the very start. The first thing is that it started at the end of the influenza season and spread around the globe in the part of the year where influenza is virtually absent. We don't see it in the summer. And, you know, at the moment, we're in its second peak. The second thing was that almost no one below the age of 50 had any immunity to it. And, you know, only about a third of the people above 60 have any antibodies whatsoever. Third thing was that it was infecting the wrong people, and still is. Instead of the majority of our major infections and deaths being found in the very old and the very young, it's hitting healthy people above 50 the hardest. And almost entirely sparing the elderly. About 88% of the deaths are under the age of 65 from this 2009 H1N1, and that compares to 90% of seasonal flu deaths that occur over the age of 65. It's very unique and very interesting, and frankly, a little bit scary.
Yeah, so a lot of people are questioning how severe this flu is, this pandemic. Do we really need to worry about it? And a couple of points that you bring up I think are worth emphasizing. One is that the regular flu kills 30 to 36,000 Americans, 500,000 people worldwide.
Absolutely.
So saying that this is, you know, no worse than the regular flu, that still makes it a very severe illness that has a lot of morbidity and mortality. But in addition to that, the H1N1 pandemic is superimposed upon now the regular seasonal flu. So we're in for a double whammy, right? I mean, this
Absolutely.
Is going to be an exceptionally right. bad flu season, essentially.
It could very well be.
Right. That's what we expect. We haven't seen much in the way of seasonal flu yet, but it's still extremely early in the season, and we wouldn't necessarily expect to see it yet. So whether or not it's going to co-circulate or whether, you know, it's going to displace the seasonal flu, I've seen opinions on either side, and I'd be interested to hear what Mark has to say.
Yeah, and the thing, most people don't worry too much because 36,000 doesn't seem like that many people, but it is about as many who get killed in car accidents and about as many that get killed by handguns, and that's a lot of people. But most people don't know anyone that's been shot or killed in a car accident.
I do. And I know someone who was killed with a firearm, too.
Yeah. So. Well, a surprising number of people don't unless you work in a trauma center.
But that's actually
it's a lot of people.
Oh, no, it's a lot of people, and it's actually a good point. The reason I say that is this happens each and every year, and people get jaded. They don't really – it's just the background noise of people who die.
That's right. And essentially, we don't know exactly how bad it's going to be because the virus may continue to mutate and it could become more virulent or more infective. But even if it is just the way it is, even if it doesn't change, we're in for a bad flu season. Already, the CDC and the which is the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta in the United States and the World Health Organization, the WHO, are reporting that the number of cases that we're seeing for this time of year is greater than is typical. The number of deaths is greater. The number of hospitalizations is greater. So far, we've seen about 1,000 deaths from H1N1 in the United States, about 5,000 worldwide. For some reason, there is excess, or most of the deaths are in the Western Hemisphere. So, again, about 20% of the deaths, worldwide deaths, have been in the United States. And as Joe was saying, it's not the typical pattern that we see for the seasonal flu. It's more people who are younger. For some reason, it's hitting pregnant women especially severely. So there is something different about this virus.
If you're over 60, if you're born before 1950, a significant percentage, like 30-40%, have antibody from H1N1 that circulated up until about 1950. So many elderly actually have protective antibody from having had flu in the 1930s, 1940s. It's all the people who were born after 1950 that have had zero exposure to the virus that are at risk. And so that's a huge population. And what tends to kill people, of course, is people that can mount a brisk immune response, and that is young people. And so the young have a double whammy for the swine flu, or the novel H1N1, as we're supposed to call it.
We're obviously not trying to drum up fear about a pandemic. This is the flu, and it's going to be an especially bad flu season, but it certainly is worth taking precautions, maybe heightening public awareness about the typical precautions that they should be taking in any case. The things that everyone can agree on is wash your hands, cough into your elbow, minimize exposure. If you feel like you're getting a flu-like illness or even just a bad cold, stay home for a couple of days to see what it's going to be. Don't be brave and go into work and spread the virus around. Employers should be lenient about letting people stay at home or keeping children home from school if they might have the flu. That's the thing I think everyone can agree about. The big controversy is about the vaccine.
Right.
So, Mark, give us a quick background on the regular influenza vaccine and for the seasonal flu and the H1N1 vaccine that is just now hitting doctors' offices.
Yeah, the regular flu efficacy is variable because it depends upon how well the vaccine matches the circulating strain. In some years, they guess better than others. But depending on the population and who you study, you can find variable effect of seasonal flu vaccine. The H1N1, we got to pick perfect. And we knew exactly the strain, and they grew it up right away. And the organism has had very little time to change its antigenic potential. So you would predict that this vaccine is going to be very good for preventing influenza. And since it's young people who need it, and they're the people who get a good response, this should be a superb vaccine if you can find it. We'll know in 9 months, but right now I would think it's going to be one of the better influenza vaccines we've had for the novel H1N1.
Right. And the early studies show that a robust response is resulting in about 95 to 100% of people who are being vaccinated.
Yeah.
If you're 6 months to 9 years old, the recommendation is to get two injections 4 weeks apart in order to produce similar robust response.
That's absolutely right.
So Joe, have you started vaccinating the children in your pediatric practice?
Well, you know, I'm in the ICU most of the time, so most of our children we're not vaccinating, but we are vaccinating the families of the kids who are particularly high risk. And the way that our hospital is currently supplied, we're still just as short as everyone else. So our main priorities have been the healthcare workers that have the most direct contact, and that's been the people in the ED and the people in the ICU.
Usually the seasonal flu doesn't peak until January. It may have something to do with the colder weather. I know there is some evidence to support that. So we should still beat the worst of it. But of course, interestingly, there's a lot of anxiety about the pandemic. There's a lot of anxiety about not having enough vaccine early enough. And yet also, there's a lot of anxiety about the vaccine itself. But before we get to the safety of the vaccine, Mark, can you give us a quick summary of the evidence for the efficacy of the flu vaccine in general? You said that the H1N1 vaccine is particularly well targeted. So it's going to be probably one of the best flu vaccines that we have, but just in general, how do we know it even works?
Well, there's a variety of studies. My personal favorite, but the least real world, where you take a bunch of people, put them in a room, you give half of them the vaccine, and you give half of them placebo, and you send them out to either get influenza or in the clinical trials, you squirt influenza in their face. And that tends to have very good efficacy under those circumstances. When you give people vaccine and then you challenge them with influenza, though I don't know who's crazy enough to do that, 60-80% of people will not get influenza as a result. In real world, of course, it's never quite that good. But generally speaking, if you get a good match, the influenza vaccine in population trials and in placebo trials usually decreases flu by 60-80% in people. Mm-hmm. Again, the problem with the influenza vaccine is this: it decreases your odds. So it's not like tetanus, which is almost 100%. Mm-hmm. And so it's always difficult when you say you're going to decrease your odds of getting flu. Mm-hmm. But it's right. What it does.
So that sort of brings up the infamous Atlantic article that has been the bane of our existence the last few weeks.
Yeah, that was a very aggravating
It was a very awful article is what it was.
Yeah, I mean, they took a very narrow perspective and then made a nice story about good versus bad to show that we don't know what we're doing with the flu vaccine, when in fact the article is true, but it's from such a narrow perspective that it is very misleading.
Well, yeah, I thought that they disingenuously conflated the seasonal flu versus pandemic flu.
Yeah, they did. It's very confusing that way. And actually, Friday's post is going to be a paragraph by paragraph discussion.
And also, I would, we could always put the link up, but Revere did a very, very nice takedown of the article. I did a bit of a, takedown of the article as my alter ego, but Revere did it the best.
Yeah, it's just a narrow perspective. And if you look at the world through a very narrow perspective, then it doesn't look good. If you take all the data, then the data for flu vaccine being efficacious for preventing disease and death is actually fairly robust. I think mm-hmm. the guy Jefferson, I'd hate to be his kid because he seems to want to have absolute perfection or nothing. And the real world is messy and ugly.
Oh, well, this is what we frequently see. Jefferson's falling into that trap, but you see it in anti-vaccinationists a lot. It's called the Nirvana fallacy or the fallacy of perfection. There are various other names for it, but basically it's like if it isn't perfect, it's not worth doing. You know, it's like if it doesn't prevent the flu 100% and if it's not 100% safe, then it's crap.
Right. Or for the evidence, if we don't have massive double-blind placebo-controlled trials, all the other evidence is crap.
Well, yeah, and Revere had the greatest term for that, methodolatry. Mm-hmm. I love that term. I mean, it's where the double-blind placebo-controlled trial. Now, yes, those are, the quote-unquote gold standard for these sorts of things. But in a pandemic situation, you don't have time to get that data, so you have to go with the data you have.
Did you ever see that BMJ article on the fact that there have never been a double-blind placebo-controlled trial on the efficacy of parachutes?
Yes, that's perfect. Yeah. I mean, but the funny thing is there have been double-blind placebo-controlled trials of flu vaccines, just that they were done so long ago for the most part that now, you know, and the evidence from multiple sources, again, this is like, it reminds me of evolution, you know, like the evidence comes from various different sources converging on the same answer, but they, you know, you can always find stuff to pick apart. You can always, and if it isn't perfect, you can, you know, they always find little things, or they always say it's not adequate, etc. But you know,
you can always move the goalpost.
It's a convergence of evidence.
That's the term I should look for.
That's right, and I think evolution and many other things like the HIV causing AIDS, for example. Those are all good examples that sometimes we have multiple independent lines of evidence all converging on a very robust answer. The vaccine is effective in reducing the risk of developing the flu, the severity of the flu. But yes, there isn't one golden study that shows all by itself
How many times have you had that question asked to you by an anti-vaccinationist? Show me the one study.
Yeah,
they want to see the one study, and you can't because it's a convergence of studies.
Yeah, that's like show me the one fossil that proves evolution. There's no such thing.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it's exactly the same thing. So they deny that the flu vaccine works when the evidence is very robust, in fact, that it does. And the H1N1 vaccine this year is going to be especially effective because it's well-targeted. And we should mention, too, at this point that there are two types of vaccines out there, basically. There's the nasal spray, which is a live attenuated virus. So this is a live virus, but the virus is attenuated, meaning it's weakened, so it cannot cause an active infection. And it's also not as effective as the other kind of vaccine, which is mainly what we've been talking about, which is the injectable vaccine, which is a killed virus. There's no live virus in that vaccine. You cannot get the flu from that vaccine.
I don't know if that difference in efficacy is really true.
Is that right? Because that's what I've read in the literature.
Journal article recently that suggested that the inhaled one is not as effective as the injectable. But part of the hypothesis for why is that people had pre-existing cross-reacting antibody that may have decreased the efficacy of the inhaled vaccine. Okay. If you go back to older trials, in the initial trials of the flu mist, it was just as good as the injectable. And there's a real hodgepodge of studies out there. Some show it's better, some show it's worse. I think that if this may be like, since no one has any antibody to it, I'm going to bet that the inhaled is probably going to be just as good for preventing disease. But all right. I don't know that for a fact.
That's good to know. So the evidence is mixed is what you're saying, and it may all average out to be to being just about as effective, the inhaled versus the injectable.
But initial trials were mostly showed equal, and some even showed superior efficacy. Again, it depends on the match of the strain to the disease and maybe pre-existing antibody.
So let's move on to safety of the vaccine. And, of course, this is a huge controversy, not a legitimate scientific controversy, but what we call a manufacturversy. Did I get that right?
Yes.
A manufacturversy.
I love that term, too.
It's a manufactured controversy mainly by ideologically dedicated anti-vaccinationists. And they have raised every possible fear they could think of. I'm going to start with a couple that I have dealt with mainly because I'm the neurologist in the group. There are a couple of neurological complications that have been raised, but then we'll talk about some other ones. So one of the big issues, because this is the quote-unquote swine flu, an unfortunate name, and we should mention that you don't get it from pigs or eating pork, despite Egypt slaughtering all their pigs.
I am eating more bacon, though, just on general principles.
So the swine or H1N1 pandemic is the same H1N1. I mean, it's a different strain. It's not the exact same strain as from 1976. But in 1976, there was also an H1N1 or so-called swine flu that was going around. It turned out that epidemic was a bit of a fizzle, but it did trigger a massive vaccination program. And there was what is now considered to be a very real increase in the risk of developing a neurological syndrome known as Guillain-Barré syndrome. This is an autoimmune disease that is triggered by infections or triggered by things that can stimulate the immune system. It's actually pretty controversial whether or not the flu vaccine can trigger Guillain-Barré syndrome. Reviews of the literature are, again, mixed. It indicates that there can be a very mild temporal relationship. People do get Guillain-Barré after getting the flu vaccine, but it's never really been demonstrated that there's a causal relationship, that the flu vaccine causes Guillain-Barré syndrome, except for perhaps this 1976 outbreak, when there was about 1 in 100,000 people who were vaccinated, excess cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, with a temporal correlation, and it is thought that that probably was an actual cause of that vaccine. It's actually not known what it was about that particular vaccine that triggered this bump in the incidence of Guillain-Barré syndrome. However, we now have 30-plus years of experience with the seasonal flu vaccine since then, and there hasn't been any clear-cut increased risk of Guillain-Barré syndrome. Some sources say that there may be an excess of one case of Guillain-Barré syndrome per million people vaccinated, one in a million. But that is a temporal correlation only without really any demonstrated cause and effect. But even if we take the worst-case scenario, that means for every million people who are vaccinated, there'll be one excess case of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which means that the benefit of the flu vaccine in terms of preventing excess deaths from the flu far outweighs, by orders of magnitude, the risk of getting Guillain-Barré syndrome from the vaccine itself. Now, just for some quick background, Guillain-Barré syndrome is a disorder in which the immune system attacks the nerves. It causes numbness and weakness. Maybe in severe cases leading to paralysis. In the very severe cases, there's a 3 to 10% mortality rate, which it results from two main things, either people becoming too weak to breathe and then are not placed on mechanical ventilation promptly enough, or from autonomic dysfunction. The autonomic nerves, the ones that control things like blood pressure and heart rate, are affected. That's actually the number one cause of death in Guillain-Barré syndrome, is the autonomic dysfunction that can occur. I think the most applicable statistics deal with Guillain-Barré syndrome following the flu vaccine, and that showed that about 3% mortality rate and 16-17% disability rate. So 80% of people who get Guillain-Barré syndrome after the flu vaccine have no long-term consequences. And if we accept the 1 in a million estimate of people who get Guillain-Barré from the flu vaccine, then we could say about 1 in 5 million will have some permanent disability, and less than 1 in 20 million will die of Guillain-Barré from the flu vaccine, compared to about 1 in 10,000 people in the general population who die from the flu itself. So again, you're talking several orders of magnitude more risk from the flu than from dying of Guillain-Barré syndrome.
To put this in perspective, I once did a comparison about vaccines and relative risks. This was like years ago, again, as my alter ego. And again, this is the fallacy of the perfect solution. For instance, I asked an anti-vaccinationist this question. Okay, you want vaccines to be perfectly safe. Do you drive your kid around in a car? Do you know how many kids die in car accidents? And then I said something along the lines of, how about this? Do you let your kids play baseball? Among children ages 5 to 14, about 100,000 kids a year are taken to the ER for injuries suffered playing baseball. It has the highest child fatality rate of any sport. About 5 kids a year die playing baseball. And they don't even think about that. But for the vaccine, if one person in a million gets Guillain-Barré, and the evidence is questionable even for that, it's a panic.
Right.
I always point out that the number of people who died in 76, and I hate to say only, because if you're one of that 25,
right,
you're toast. But about 50 people died, maybe, from Guillain-Barré, which is how many die every year from airbags. Mm-hmm. So you're going to take your airbags out of your car?
Right.
It's also the number of people who get trampled to death by cattle every year in the United States. And I don't think we're going to dismember the beef industry anytime soon.
Well, here's another example. Swimming. Mm-hmm. And I happen to pull up my post. So I'm like, about 5,000 kids under 14 are hospitalized due to unintentional drowning-related incidents each year. 15% of them die in the hospital, and as many as 20% of them suffer severe permanent neurologic injury.
That's right. So if you put it in perspective, it's a minuscule risk with a profound benefit. And yet people let their kids swim, drive in cars. They have airbags in their cars. They don't think twice about it. But people are very bad at estimating risk naively. We tend to overreact to small risks and ignore much bigger risks. But when we use statistics and science to tell us what we really should be concerned about, it's not the vaccine, right? Vaccines are one of the safest medical interventions that are there, which is not to say it's risk-free. That's a straw man that the anti-vaccinators often throw out there, that we're trying to say that vaccines have zero risk. We've never said that. There are definitely risks to vaccines that are well-known and well-tracked. But all we're saying is that the benefits far outweigh the risks. Medicine is all about risk versus benefit. And with vaccines, it's really a no-brainer.
I don't know. After this talk, I'm not going to drive my kids to the swimming pool anymore.
Especially if you're going to play baseball in the interim, right?
Yeah. Well, they play pool baseball. So I think they'll just stay home.
One last word on the Guillain-Barré syndrome, that because of the 1976 experience, both the UK and the United States are actually rolling out a monitoring system. And as a neurologist, in fact, I was contacted by the state of Connecticut. They want us to report all cases of Guillain-Barré to the state so that it can be tracked. So if there is a bump in Guillain-Barré syndrome following the rollout of the vaccine, we will detect it as early as possible. No one's really expecting that there will be one. The 30 years of experience that we have without excess cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, probably except maybe one in a million, is very reassuring. But just in case, the decision was made to monitor very closely.
Of course, the wackaloons think that's because the government knows it's going to cause Guillain-Barré as part of the cover-up.
That's right.
There was one of the rare incidents of a decent article on, you know, relative risks, as they point out that more than 3,000 people a day have a heart attack. But if you're one of them who has a heart attack the day after your swine flu shot, you know that there's going to be people trying to blame the vaccine for the MI.
Right.
You know, you have to look at the epidemiology. And this is the same thing with vaccines and autism.
It was pointed out at the national meetings I was at last week that if you look at the spontaneous abortion rates that women just naturally have when they're pregnant, and if they manage to vaccinate half of all the pregnant women in the United States, the guy said that 1,200 women would have a spontaneous abortion within 24 hours of the vaccine, just as part of the background.
Oh, I could believe that.
So it's important to know the background rate before you start crediting cause and effect.
Absolutely. But the media will jump on dramatic cases. And this leads to another topic I wanted to talk about, which was the cheerleader case, which is making the rounds in the media.
And still making the rounds.
Still, and the anti-vaccination groups like Generation Rescue have jumped on this case to exploit it in order to, again, further scaremonger about vaccines. Very quickly, again, I wrote about this in detail, so on Neurologic, I have two blog posts exploring this, but very quickly, 25-year-old girl claims that she got a movement disorder that it was diagnosed as dystonia 10 days following getting the flu vaccine. This is now being promoted as a rare flu reaction. Again, we have a correlation which does not necessarily imply causation in this case. But also, I'll just say that there's a lot of questions about what this woman, Desiree Jennings, really has. The experts, the movement disorder experts who have looked at the public video evidence that the media is showing are in agreement that this is not consistent with dystonia and that it is not consistent with something that could happen as a vaccine reaction. So this is not even a rare reaction to a vaccine in all probability, but that's not stopping the media from making some hay out of it, and also not stopping the anti-vaccinationists from exploiting this case as another case of a vaccine injury, when in fact it is almost definitely not a case of vaccine injury.
But it is very interesting how Generation Rescue had this page up asking for money for a fund that they set up with the Bank of America called, I forget, something about Help Desiree or whatever it was, and it's gone now.
They put it back up, though. So they may have had brief doubts about the case when the dystonia community contacted them, essentially to tell them that this is not a case of real dystonia, but of something else. And however, apparently in the end, they decided to go on the offensive to attack those physicians who were pointing out that the evidence that is in the public domain is not consistent with the diagnosis of dystonia or a vaccine injury. And then, as predicted, Desiree Jennings was put in the hands of an anti-vaccine physician, Rashid Batar, who treated her with chelation therapy. And by her and his report, she was getting better within minutes of getting the chelation and had a complete recovery within about a day and a half. Again, not possible if this was actually due to damage to the brain due to some toxin, whether mercury or something else, and actually confirms the impression of the movement disorder specialists that this was not a brain injury.
I sense J.B. Handley's hand in this.
Yes.
Because he just cannot admit when he's wrong. He's incapable of it. And, you know, that brings up the story of Amy Wallace and that lovely story that was in Wired magazine a couple weeks ago.
That was a great story.
It was. It was a good, solid report on the culture of fear, fear-mongering surrounding the vaccine. So a bit of good reporting, which we like to see every now and then in the mainstream media. So, David, why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the other focuses of fear of the vaccine, specifically some of the ingredients that are in the vaccine?
Oh, yes. Well, this is a long and sordid story that isn't it ain't just for the flu vaccine, as we say, but that's been, you know, turned up to 11, so to speak, for the flu vaccine. There is the thimerosal. The point being that, yes, some of the flu vaccines contain thimerosal. There are thimerosal-free options. There's the flu mist, you know, which, of course, can't have thimerosal in it or it would kill the virus and there would be no immune response from the attenuated virus. But they bring it up because it is the dreaded mercury. And unfortunately, for them, for the anti-vaccinationists, there have been the evidence that against thimerosal being causally related to autism is so ridiculously overwhelming that it's hard to emphasize just how bad their case is. I mean, they had the problem with thimerosal is they made a testable hypothesis, which is that if you got rid of the thimerosal, autism rate should fall, and they haven't, not even close. And thimerosal has been out of most vaccines since the end of 2001. And, you know, in addition, if you add up the rate, you add up the amount of thimerosal in the entire vaccination schedule, you know, it's clearly below what it was in the 1980s right mm-hmm. now. Trace thimerosal right now. So you would expect that autism would have fallen to 1980s rates or at least be on its way by now. It's not. That's really powerful evidence against it.
Right, but they're never ones to be confused by the facts. They were profoundly wrong in their prediction, whereas those of us, literally, we put our nickel down and said there will not be a decrease in autism rates of increase.
I said on many occasions, yeah. If there was a decrease in autism rates, I would rethink my position.
Absolutely. We were happy to adjust our opinion based upon the evidence, and our predictions were based upon the evidence pointing against the link between thimerosal and autism, that therefore you would predict there shouldn't be a decrease, and there wasn't. The rate of increase continued without even a blip, and still continues. Right. And again, I'll emphasize, this is the rate of diagnoses,
right.
Not necessarily the true rate of autism.
That's just way too much to get into now, but the argument.
Right, but just the quick summary, there isn't really an autism epidemic. There's an increasing number of diagnoses, probably due to expanding the diagnosis and increased surveillance. That's what the consensus of the data shows. But the anti-vaccinationists will say there's still thimerosal in the vaccines. There's still mercury in the vaccines, but they're really talking about the trace levels that are left behind
right.
from the manufacturing process, which are truly biologically negligible. And it's completely dishonest for them to say that it's still there.
I think in the flu vaccine, they're still using the standard amount of thimerosal. I think there's 25 micrograms there, but...
It is. It's 25 micrograms.
In the multi-dose. In the multi-dose. Yeah, exactly. But
in the multi-dose vials, right.
In the single-dose vial, there's only the trace amount left behind by the manufacturing process. Most of it is actually removed in the purification
process.
Right,
okay.
Right.
Now, you can list any, you know, this is what I've called in the past the toxins gambit, or the, oh my God, the toxins gambit. It's one of those things where, okay, you exonerate one ingredient and the anti-vaccine crowd rapidly moves on to another. The idea being that it's, it would be virtually impossible to test each and every single ingredient in sequence, individually, with randomized clinical trials or whatever.
And for every single possible disease.
And then for every single possible combination.
Yes.
Right. But
like, for example, you know, in France, they think that thimerosal or vaccines causes multiple sclerosis, right? So when I guess when the vaccine, the anti-vaccine crowd's done with autism, they'll move on to multiple sclerosis or something else. As long as there's something to blame on vaccines.
I think they were blaming hepatitis B vaccine on multiple sclerosis, and looks like we're probably circling back, as you said, to that.
Right.
The most amazing study, of course, was the monkey study that they did recently, which, okay, this is, you gotta love the disingenuousness of the anti-vaccine movement. In the intro, they just say, okay, we're worried about children in other countries who are still getting thimerosal-containing vaccines, you know, hepatitis B vaccine. But in the experiment, they actually, you know, using the monkeys, they actually added thimerosal to the hepatitis B vaccine to duplicate the hepatitis B vaccine as it was given in the 1990s, you know, in the U.S. So it's totally disingenuous. Right. But in any case, it was a horrible, horrible study. Very small numbers. The randomization was highly suspect. They looked at, in an older version of the study that they posted on as an abstract for an autism conference, they had measured 18 different reflexes, and somehow in the final there were only 13 that they measured. They apparently didn't control for multiple comparisons, as far as I can tell. It's just an awful, awful study, but it's being held up as, here it is, hepatitis B vaccine causes the autism, you know, or right. causes, you know.
Autism-like features in monkeys, which...
Right. Autism-like features in infant macaque monkeys.
Right. So they have their very, very suspect evidence that they can point to, but it stands at odds with the bulk of the scientific evidence, which shows that there's no link. The other ingredient that I think has come to prominence with the flu vaccine is squalene. Why don't you tell us about that?
Even though it's not in this flu vaccine being sold in the United States.
That's right. I don't think I've seen any of the sites actually go out of their way to point that out. They just have squalene in big flashing letters, but they don't point out that it actually won't be in the U.S. version of the vaccine, right?
Yeah, but Joe wrote in a very, very good post about that issue, so perhaps he could take on squalene.
Sure. So. At the very beginning, we were looking. We weren't sure exactly what type of response we were going to have with the influenza vaccine, and just planning ahead for not having enough doses and trying to vaccinate as many people as needed to be vaccinated. People were looking at different options. One of those options would be to add an adjuvant so that we can get away with using less antigen per dose and still have an adequate immune response. One of the things that we use right now is aluminum, but in Europe, they've been using squalene for close to a decade, specifically in their influenza vaccines. They've administered tens of millions of doses of squalene, and there's a few other names that
companies use for it. It's an MF59 or something
like that. Yeah, MF59 is one of them. Yeah, they're very disingenuous. And number one, all of our organizations determined that we didn't need to include an adjuvant in influenza vaccine at all. Number two, they're starting to cite some of the other data which made them really suspicious about squalene, and one of them was citing that the anthrax vaccine in the Gulf War, they claimed had squalene in it. If you go back and look at the data, they're looking at the presence of anti-squalene antibodies in people, and really, to cut a long story short, squalene is a naturally occurring substance of the human body. Everybody, or a large percentage of the population, pardon me, has anti-squalene antibodies. And when they really looked at it, number one, there was no squalene in the anthrax vaccine anyway. And number two, the number of people that had anti-squalene antibodies was exactly the same as people who did and did not receive that vaccine. So it's groundless. With the best data they can present, they've got no case whatsoever.
They got everything wrong.
Everything.
There was no squalene in there. Squalene is safe. The antibodies were background and not related to the vaccine, and it doesn't correlate with any disease that we know of. So they managed to get every single component of their claim wrong.
And it's important to remember that, as you said, squalene is a precursor of cholesterol synthesis. So
right.
If you're going to make cholesterol, you're going to have squalene in your pathway.
Even better, squalene is in a lot of various supplements that are sold for various issues. So, in the alternative medicine world, there's lots of squalene in various supplements,
and also in cosmetics and just things like that as well. I mean, it's very commonly used in industry.
I mean, to increase the flu vaccination take, I was thinking of offering a free tuna fish sandwich with every flu shot, but maybe that would
be counterproductive. Double your dose of squalene or something?
And mercury. Get two for the price of one.
Well, no, when I went to get my seasonal flu shot, I asked them for extra thimerosal.
Mm-hmm. men take thimerosal.
It's like, I don't think you gave me enough. I want more.
When people tell me about the mercury, I always point out that as a kid, I loved to break open the thermometers and play with them. But for some reason, they don't take that as convincing evidence.
Yeah, I'm not sure you help your case there, Mark.
But you bring up tuna fish. I mean, the evidence shows that people get exposed to far more mercury from fish than any other source, certainly than from vaccines.
Well, actually, there was that study where, where they looked at, it's another study the anti-vaccinations are trying to push, although it doesn't really show what they think it shows. But, they found that, the blood mercury levels were the same, mm-hmm. whether in autistic kids as in non-autistic kids. And the single biggest determinant of blood mercury levels was, how much seafood they ate.
That's right. That's exactly right. Not how vaccinated they were.
Remember I said eat more bacon?
eat more fish or eat more bacon?
More bacon. You avoid the mercury and you decrease the swine, but not the swine flu.
Well, the issue of adjuvants actually is interesting in a way because I'm going to cite Revere again. He did he talked about this issue, and not using adjuvants means that the United States has bought up more antigen and more virus, more antigen than any other country, and arguably because of that there will be countries that will not be able to get the vaccine in as large a numbers. And he actually argued that we should have adjuvants in our vaccine so that we could use less antigen, so that we could use so we could make more doses with the same amount of antigen.
Right. That's an interesting point.
He made a pretty compelling argument to me.
Yeah, in a way, we're being selfish. Getting a non-adjuvanted vaccines, we're depriving other countries of having enough antigen to go around, basically. Well, I think we covered all the main topics that we wanted to talk about. The bottom line is that the vaccine works, the vaccine is safe, it's been around for decades, it has been tested, it's going to be well-targeted against H1N1. You should get vaccinated. We should bring up the notion of herd immunity, that I know a lot of people think, well, I'm healthy, I can survive the flu, I don't need to get vaccinated. First of all, that's not necessarily true with this strain. Young, healthy people are dying from this flu as well. But also, most of the benefit may be to other people out there, people who can't get vaccinated or are immunocompromised or have chronic illness. And if we can get to somewhere reasonably near herd immunity, where enough people have resistance that the virus cannot easily spread around, that's the biggest benefit from the vaccine. But all of the scaremongering that's happening is almost guaranteeing that we're not going to achieve herd immunity levels. We'll see. We're dealing with battling fears. In Canada, for example, a lot of people were indicating that they were not going to take the flu vaccine, but then a 14-year-old healthy hockey player died of H1N1, and now they can't give it out fast enough. They're running out of vaccine. Everyone's lining up to get it. So we'll just have to wait and see how it plays out. But as always, we recommend that you listen to the scientific evidence and not the sensationalistic fear-mongering that's going around the media.
The one thing I will say is because of the uncertainties and the problems with seasonal flu vaccination. You know, this whole it's a custom-made situation for, you know, denialists like, you know, anti-vaccinationists to do, you know, the sowing of fear and doubt, and they're taking full advantage, and they're, you know, I think, again, either through ignorance or through dishonesty, and I think it depends who it is, but they're intentionally conflating, you know, the problems with seasonal flu vaccination to vaccination during a pandemic.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Well, David Gorski, Mark Krislip, Joe Albeats, thank you for joining me for this special episode to get everybody up to date on the H1N1 pandemic and the vaccination program.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
All right. Good night, everyone. This has been a special episode of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. I'd like to thank my colleagues at the Science-Based Medicine blog, Dave, Mark, and Joe, for joining me for this special report on the H1N1 pandemic. You can read our writings on this topic and other topics of science and medicine at www.sciencebasedmedicine.org. You can also listen to Mark Krislip on his podcast, Quackcast. I also contribute on similar topics to my personal blog, Neurologica, which you can find through the Skeptic's Guide homepage as well as through the Science-Based Medicine page. Thanks for joining us for this special episode, and we'll catch you next time at the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.